Ladies and gentlemen, and fellow golfers, for your entertainment.
It's the Golf to Go Hour with Frank LaRosa, brought to you by Hagen Oaks, America's most awarded golf facility, and Naturewood Home Furnishings, where it's all about choices and always about quality.
It's time for the Golf to Go Radio Hour here on Sports 1140 KHTK. Hi, Frank LaRosa here, along with co-host Scott Marsh. And Scott, an exciting week. This is Masters Week.
The Masters Week is always the best week of the year. And, of course, this will be the best Masters tournament I will have ever experienced, obviously.
Yeah, pretty exciting. You got to go down to South Carolina, play some golf, and spend some time at the Masters. And we're going to talk a little bit about that this week. But we're going to talk more about it next week after we talk about an interview with Bob Jones IV, who was the grandson Bobby Jones, the co-founder of the Masters and Augusta National. But I had the opportunity to interview Bob as one of my people who play the game interviews. And he talks, you know, a lot about growing up and having Bobby as a grandfather, and certainly about the Masters. And it's kind of a fun interview. So we're going to break that up a little bit. And then towards the end of the show, you and I are going to talk about your experience at the Masters a little bit, kind of tease next week.
Yeah, no, I can't wait to do it. It was an experience of a lifetime, and honestly, a golf trip of a lifetime, not just going to the Masters, but being at Hilton Head and being able to play at Harbortown, where the RBC Heritage Tournament is upcoming, play on that course as well. That was spectacular. So truly, it's been a wonderful past week for me in the golf world.
Yeah. Weren't you the last group out before they got ready for that tournament this week?
We had the very last tee time. There were a couple of PGA people playing behind us who jumped on, but they didn't have an official tee time. And so we were racing to get to the famed 18th lighthouse, green before it got too dark. We got there at sunset right around 8 o'clock, made it through, had some great views. The golf was up and down. Some of it was good. Some of it wasn't so good, but we were on a number of spectacular courses, and in Harbortown certainly was the crowning jewel on Sunday afternoon.
That's exciting. Well, we're going to hear more about that a little later on in the show, and certainly more next week as well. This is the Golf to Go Radio Hour. We'll be back right after these messages with Bob Jones IV, the grandson of Bobby Jones.
It's the Golf to Go Hour with Frank LaRosa.
Today's People Who Play the Game segment is very exciting to me. We are with Dr. Robert T. Jones IV. He's a licensed psychologist at the Behavioral Institute of Atlanta. Dr. Jones is a nationally recognized sports psychologist. He's appeared on many major sports networks, including Golf Channel, ESPN, and NBC Sports. He's also the grandson of a name you'd recognize, Mr. Robert T. Jones Jr. He's more affectionately known as Bobby Jones, who, of course, is the founder of the Augusta National Golf Club and the Masters Tournament. Dr. Bob, welcome so much to People Who Play the Game. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Frank. It's great to be with you today. Thanks for having me.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I've seen some of the interviews that you've done over the years, and it's with such grace that you represent not only your grandfather, but in many ways, the whole game of golf, and the people that we meet in the game. I don't know that I've ever met anyone that I haven't been able to get along with. But the folks that you see, the places you go, to be able to spread the good word as you do about your grandfather and about the good of the game. Congratulations. I'm so happy to have you with us today.
Well, thank you so much. That means quite a bit. One of the things I always like to remind people that I learned from my grandfather is that the game is so much bigger than any of us are individually. And it's a game that's built not only on excellence and expertise, but it is also built on fellowship and integrity. And I think my grandfather embodied those virtues certainly as well as better than most, and better than most, I would say. And I'm very proud of what he has done and how he lived his life, how he played the game. And I'm glad to contribute to that in whatever small way that I can.
You know, he had an iconic life, obviously, and he was a very well-read man, and he had multiple degrees. But I'll have you talk about that. But let's start at the beginning. He had kind of a tough life in the beginning. He was very ill as a young boy, and kind of learned on his own how to be on his own in many ways.
He did. He grew up in Atlanta, Georgia. He was born on St. Patrick's Day of 1902. This just recently would have been his 120th birthday. Wow. And he had some very unusual digestive problems. Never really ate solid food until he was about 5 years old. But fortunately, about that same time, something happened that totally changed his life and the golf world. And that was his parents took a summer residence out at a new club that the Atlanta Athletic Club had built called East Lake, which at that time was way on the outskirts of town. Now we call it downtown, but back then it was not. And at the same time, a professional came to East Lake named Stuart Maiden. And Bub learned the game of golf by imitating the swing of Stuart Maiden. Got to the point, you know, he played in his first tournament when he was 6 years old, a little six-hole affair at East Lake with himself and three of his friends. Won his first state amateur championship when he was 14 years old in 1916. He was the club champion of both East Lake and Druid Hills Golf Club when he was 13. And then he played in his first national championship, the U.S. Amateur in Marion in 1916. He then struggled with seven lean years, as the golf writer O.B. Keeler called them, before winning the 1923 U.S. Open in Inwood out in Long Island. And then after that, Frank, he never had a year between there and 1930 where he did not hold at least one USGA title. Wow. Between that time, from 1923 to 1930, he won 13 major championships, four United States Opens. He would have won five had he not called a penalty on himself in 1925. He won five United States Amateurs. He won three British Opens, and he won one British Amateur. Nobody ever beat him in match play twice, and the worst that he ever finished in a United States Open was a tie for 11th. So, and by the way, while he was doing that, he became the first man in history to win the double, which is both open championships in the same year. And he became so far the only man in history to win the Grand Slam, which was all four major championships in the same calendar year. After that, he retired and, spent his time writing books, making instructional films that are still considered to be state of the art. And then he built a golf course and a golf tournament about 130 miles to the east of where I'm sitting right now, and formed a tournament called the Augusta National Invitational, which later came to be known as the Masters. It's an incredible life. I mean, any one of those things would be an absolutely incredible accomplishment in life. But for all of them to be in with one man, it's just mind-boggling. And then to realize the grace and dignity with which he did all of it, even including enduring a horrible, horrible, crippling spinal disease, makes his life, I think, is one for the ages, and certainly one of which I'm very proud.
As well you should be, as well as all of us should be. You know, he also did that. He also took the time along the way to get a couple of degrees and become an attorney and want to noodle around a lot. He wanted to learn. He wanted to know things and how they worked.
Oh, he very definitely did. The funniest thing, though, about his law career, you know, he always had a wonderful sense of humor. There was a thing that was in the movie Bobby Jones' Stroke of Genius, which was actually a true story. When he started practicing law, he had this man who came to see him, an old family friend, and he said, and I don't remember what his name was, he said, Bob, I want to sue Harold. And my grandfather said, well, what do you want to sue Harold for? He said, well, I just want to sue him. He said, well, my grandfather said, well, yes, I know that, but you have to sue him for something. What do you want to sue him for? And the old man looked at my grandfather and said, well, Bob, he told me to go to hell. And my grandfather said, well, yeah, but I don't think? And the guy said, I don't think you understand, Bob. He told me to go to hell. And Bob got up from his desk. He walked back behind his desk, grabbed a law book, took it out, thumbed through it a little bit. And he turned back and he said, okay, well, I understand your complaint. I understand your complaint, John, but I've checked the law on that and you don't have to go. And after that, they started laughing and everything was fine. So he also had, in addition to that curiosity and how things work, he was also very intrigued by how people work too. So
apparently, if I remember the story, he was out at Pebble Beach playing in a U.S. amateur. Was that what it was?
And, it was.
And didn't get out of the first round and decided yes. to go over to Cypress Point. Tell me that
well,
story.
The Cypress Point match, I think, actually took place slightly before. He was scheduled to play at Cypress Point anyway. Cypress had not exactly opened up, and they were going to play just this very, very calm, quiet, nobody around, little round. Dr. McKenzie would be there. I forget who the other two that were going to be playing in the foursome were. One of them was a very young man, fine player, hit the ball a mile. And so he basically played the inaugural round at Cypress. And his other plan was that after the U.S. amateur, he was going to go over to inaugurate the great Pasa Tiempo Golf Club, where he played with one of his dear friends, Marion Hollins, who finally got inaugurated into the World Golf Hall of Fame just recently. She was selected for it back in 2020, but, well, we all know how that went. And so Marion Hollins, in fact, when Augusta National opened, Marion Hollins was a frequent visitor to Augusta National. So, yeah.
Pretty exciting names. Dr. McKenzie, who is obviously one of the best golf architects ever, and Bobby Jones, who also can, that description serves well, the best ever, kind of got together and decided that they were going to maybe build a golf course in Augusta. How'd that come about?
Well, that's probably a story that in order to fully tell it would take a lot more time than we would have. But I will just say that it started out when the Fruitlands Nursery became available for development. Bub met with a New York financier, Clifford Roberts, and they went out to visit Fruitlands, which was just a shell of its former self. Fruitlands was one of the biggest indigo plantations in the United States, indigo being a very important dye that was used in the manufacture of clothing. In fact, if you go to the clubhouse to this day, if you come out the clubhouse like you're heading towards the first tee, there is a big oak tree that's right up against the clubhouse, and you'll see an indigo vine that goes up the side of that tree. That is one of the original indigo vines from when the Berkmans owned Fruitlands Nursery. Uh-huh. Still there. But he walked out on that property and he overlooked the vista that he saw all the way from across from what would be now number 10 all the way across. And he said, to think that this land has been here all this time, just waiting for a golf course to be laid out upon it. And in fact, he said, I can almost see it in my mind's eye right now. They got Augusta National going. They originally had hoped to make it a huge national club with a national membership and make it really popular. But unfortunately, the Great Depression had other plans. And they were able to put the 18 holes together that we see now, mostly by manual labor. Even in the Depression, they paid a reasonable wage for the time, but people worked from what they used to call in the South can to can't, which means from when you can see to when you can't see. And, they had to go down and dredge out that whole area where Amen Corner is located now. And even to this day, if you get over in that spot between 12 green and 13 tee on the tee side of Ray's Creek, that is still one of the wettest spots on the golf course, as Jordan Spieth found out a few years ago. That it still doesn't, and that is still an artifact of how that turf actually was when they built the golf course. The course really struggled for many, many years. Finally, you know, they shut down in World War II, and it was really debatable if they were ever going to open it up again. Wow. And then after the war, Cliff Roberts suggested that Bud go visit a banker up at First National City Bank of New York to get funding to reopen the course. And so Bud went up there, and because Cliff felt it would be much harder for him to say no to Bobby Jones than it would be to say no to Cliff Roberts. And so they negotiated these terms, and Bub said, we called my grandfather Bub, said, well, you know, now, Alan, I'm going to have to call Cliff and run this by him and make sure that this is okay before I sign the paper. And Alan said, that's fine. And so they bring in the portable phone, which back in those days meant a phone with about an 85-foot cord. And they dial up Cliff, and Bub gets on the phone. He says, Cliff, it's Bob. I'm up here with Alan, and here are the terms that he's given us for the reopening of Augusta National. And Bub laid out what the terms were, and Cliff went ballistic. He was cursing. He was screaming. He was like, I'm not going to authorize any. And it was so bad. Bub had to hold the phone out like a foot from his ear because Cliff was just that loud. Bub heard it. The secretaries in the hall heard it. Alan certainly heard it. The people out in the street probably heard it through open windows. And finally afterwards, Cliff winds down and Bub says, all right, Cliff. All right. Well, I will take care of it and I will see you in just a couple of weeks. And he hung up, and Alan looks over at Bub and he says, well, Bob, what did Cliff say? Well, everybody knew what Cliff said. And Bub just looked at him and said, Alan, Cliff said that'd be fine. And Augusta National reopened.
What a great sense of humor he had as well.
Oh, he did. He absolutely did. He absolutely did.
So it reopened. Originally, the plans were much more grandiose than it actually ended up being. Wasn't there supposed to be two golf courses?
That was the original plan. The thought was that there would be a championship course, because ultimately what they wanted was to hold the United States Open. And then they were also going to put a course, I believe the original plan, I've got to check with a historian about that just to double check, but I believe the plan was also to build a course for women there as well, because the whole point of attracting people down to that part of the country at that time of year was so that couples could come together and be together. And so that was the plan. The plan was to raise the Berkman's home, which is now the clubhouse, and build a more fitting clubhouse. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a very funny thing, Frank, if you stop and think about it, if any one of those things had happened, the magic that is that place would never have happened.
Yeah.
You know, if Augusta National had hit it big right off the bat and never had that financial crises that they went through, if they didn't have to go through the explosion of interest in the game in the late 1950s when Palmer came along, we might not think of Augusta National any more, the Masters Tournament, any more than we think of any of the bigger non-major tournaments that are played on the PGA Tour to this day. So what seemed in the beginning to be incredible streaks of adversity actually turned out in the long run to have been tremendous opportunity.
Ken Venturi used to say, fate has a way of bending the twig.
Yes, it does.
And that's really when you think about Augusta National and the Masters, you know, the word magic comes to mind, because there were so many things, as you just said, that happened that, you know, kind of led to the aura of what it is today. When did the thought of having this tournament actually come about? And I understand your grandfather, you know, wasn't a fan of the name, but when did the discussion first start?
Oh, I think that was always in the plans. It certainly, I know, was in Cliff's plans. Bub's plan was a little different. Bub intended it to be a tournament that that where he could get his old golfing friends together, and just they could go out and just play. You know, even from the very earliest days, anybody who teed up in the Masters got a check. there was no penalty for missing the cut, so to speak. Might not even have been a cut in the first few years. His plan was to call it the Augusta National Invitation. And Cliff thought that was a great idea, too, to have the tournament, because then we could get, he could get press who were on the way down for all, going down and back from spring training to stop in Augusta and cover the tournament and give it a national exposure. And Bub was insistent that it be the Augusta National Invitation. But Cliff went around behind him and went to several of the golf writers and got it called the Masters instead. Well, Bub didn't exactly care for that. And privately, he would refer to it for many, many years as the so-called Masters. And then finally in 1960, when Arnold Palmer won it for the second time in such dramatic fashion, Bub finally broke down. He was a stubborn man and he didn't break down often, but this time he did. He broke down and he said, well, I suppose the Masters is appropriately named after all, which for him was as close as you were ever going to get to hear him say, I was wrong. So
the relationship between he and O.B. Keeler was, you know, if the movie had, you know, any sense of reality to it, it seemed like a very special relationship. And whether that was true or not, or whether, you know, Keeler was just assigned to cover this young man who was, you know, breaking all these records from, you know, from the South. Tell me about that relationship.
Well, you know, I think the relationship, talk about what was the Venturi phrase again? That fate has a way of bending the twig?
Yes.
I think that's it. I think to a certain extent, Keeler was originally just assigned to cover this kid. But O.B. Keeler ended up, first of all, there wasn't quite as big an age difference between the men as it was, as you saw in the movie, where, you know, Malcolm McDowell played O.B. Keeler as this sage in his 60s. O.B. Keeler was very much in his, probably in his 30s at that time, and was a very, he was a brilliant writer. When he was with the Kansas City Star, he probably wrote one of the most brilliant pieces ever written in 1912 about the sinking of the Titanic, which was marvelous. He was the one who covered the horrific lynching of a Jewish man in Atlanta named Leo Frank. Who was later falsely, it was found out after he was lynched, falsely accused of killing a young girl named Mary Fagan. And Keeler was always an advocate for Frank. And I say this because I think OB went a long way in encouraging Bub in the development of Bub's sense of fairness and equality. I was almost going to use the word equity, but unfortunately, that's been so politically loaded these days, it's kind of hard to really define. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean, it just makes it harder to define. So I would say fairness and equality, which I also think in the long run had something to do with leading Bub to be a lawyer, because ultimately, that's what the law is all about. You have two advocates who are presenting cases so that it can be decided in equity. Right. And so Keeler, I think, was extremely influential in forming Bub as a person. But Keeler was more than that. He was also a sports psychologist back before any of us existed.
Oh, wow.
I mean, in the 1923 Open, I think it was in 23, he turned to my grandfather. My grandfather had just blown a big lead over Cruikshank and had to go into a playoff the next day. And Keeler looked at him and he said, young man, he said, you are the greatest golfer in the world. And if you ever get that thought through your head, you're not only going to win this championship, but you're going to win a lot of them. And that really stuck with Bub. And then Keeler turned to him and he said, oh, by the way, this came for you. And he handed him a telegram, which was from my grandfather's grandfather, my great-great-grandfather, who was a very barrel-chested, very devout Christian businessman who did not believe in doing silly things like playing sports on the Lord's Day. And he handed a telegram to my grandfather and he said, by the way, this came for you. And Bub opened it up before he went to the first tee. And all it said was, if you must play on the Lord's Day, play well. grandfather.
Wow.
And Bub went out and won his first of 13 major championships that day.
It's the Golf to Go Hour with Frank LaRosa.
You had a moment where you were at Augusta National, kind of looking around and taking in the place, and then you had a conversation with your grandfather afterward.
I did. I was 12 years old. It was my first year at the Masters. Back then, Cliff had a rule that nobody could attend the Masters until they were 12. And I'd gotten in the dead of night the night before, and I went to sleep in the Jones cabin. And the next morning, I woke up at 6:15. I've always been a bit of an early riser. And I walked out onto the porch of the Jones cabin, and there in front of me in the early morning light was Augusta National. Nobody was there yet. The mowers were just starting to move across the property. And all of a sudden, it hit me like a ton of bricks that all of this, everything that I was seeing, had existed in my grandfather's mind before a shovel full of dirt had ever been turned over on the property. And that absolutely floored me, because even though I knew Bub and I knew my grandfather, it was the first time that I had encountered Bobby Jones and the magnitude of who Bobby Jones was. And that was when I first started connecting the fact that those two were the same man. The next week when I called him, I used to call him every week, and I got on the phone with him, and I said, "Hi, Bub." He said, "Hey, son." He said, "I heard you went to the Masters." And I said to him, I said, "Yes, sir, I did." He said, "Well, what did you think?" I said, "Bub, I thought it was just absolutely fantastic. It's the most special thing I've ever seen." And he was quiet for a bit. And then he just said, "Well, that's fine." And it wasn't until many years later, I was talking to my wife, Mimi, about it. And I told her that story. And she said, "Yeah, you know why he paused, don't you?" And I said, "No, why?" And she said, "It's probably because that was something he was always hoping that he would be able to share with you, but his health didn't let him." And I'd never thought about it that way before. You know, it's very funny. I see so many people who go to the Masters for the first time and they really enjoy the experience. And yeah, I'm not a member at Augusta or anything like that, but it gives me a really big sense of pride, because I realize that my grandfather, that's a real monument to my grandfather. But the other thing that makes me very, very proud is that when I am there, I have connections and memories of, I remember being with my dad and my dad's friends. And I remember all the many people that I've met from the time I was 12 until now, when I'm almost 65. You know, people who would come up to me and they'd see my badge and they'd ask me, was I related to Bobby Jones? And I would tell them, and these would be very old people who'd been coming to the tournament for years. And they'd say things to me like, "Wow, you know, I remember when I was first coming here, I met your grandfather when he was being driven around on the golf cart with your dad." And they would say to me things like, you know, and he would spend time talking to me and wanting to know what I thought about things. And they always would finish with the same sentence. They'd look at me and say, "And you know, Mr. Jones, they didn't have to do that, but they did." And, you know, sometimes that means more to me than some of the memories of the great shots that I've seen hit there. Because I've often thought that the game of golf, as I think I started with, it really is more than just expertise. It's also about friendship, fellowship, and integrity. And just like life comes full circle, I guess so does this.
He was a man first. And
yes, he was.
And for people to appreciate that is the best compliment. You know, in another interview, I had asked you once, what is Bob Jones' most significant contribution to the game of golf? And you were kind of aghast and wondered how you could even answer that question. But I thought your answer was really, really fitting. And so I'll ask you that again.
Okay.
Tell me, you know, what is the most significant contribution to the game of golf from your grandfather?
The reason it's a difficult question is because there is no part of the game of golf as we know it today that was not in some way or another influenced by Robert T. Jones Jr. Absolutely no other part. He is probably the most singularly important individual to have played the game. Certainly, the only other people that might be in that league might be old Tom Morris. But think about it this way. We have four major championships. Why do we have four? He won four. When the pros were looking in 1960, when Bob Drum and Arnold Palmer were looking at coming up with a fourth tournament to fill out the professional Grand Slam, what did they choose? They chose the Masters, the tournament that my grandfather founded on the course that my grandfather built at the club that my grandfather co-founded. When the USGA gives out its absolute highest honor, what is it they give? They give the Bob Jones Award for Sportsmanship. Who is the second American in history to be given the freedom of the city of the Royal Burgh of St. Andrews, Scotland? Robert Tyre Jones Jr. in 1958. The other American to receive that award? Benjamin Franklin. There has been no one person. He changed equipment. He changed golf writing. He's the one that did instructional videos in 1932 and 3 that are still considered state of the art. And he did it without ever losing interest in the common average person. Because as he used to always say to me, you know, son, never forget that sometimes the big people in life can be really, really small. And the small people in life will be the biggest people you ever meet. And I think for all of those reasons, I think the reason that question is hard to answer is because there is no part of the game of golf that we have to this day that has not had the mark of Bobby Jones placed somewhere on it.
Brilliant, brilliant. The Masters has, it's our, especially for people on the East Coast, it's the kickoff to the golf season. Mm-hmm. It's birds chirping, it's flowers, it's Valhalla. It's a place we want to be. You know, we all want to be there. We and be a part of it. And that's pretty hard to maintain, you know, to be able to do that year after year and have people, well, I've seen that before and not lose interest. Over the years, the Masters has been very good at introducing new things. I mean, I think it was the first golf tournament to be heard on the radio, the first with bleachers.
Well, not on the radio, because my grandfather's tournaments, certainly in 1930, were all broadcast on the radio.
Oh, okay.
Grantland Rice announced them. But it was the first where they roped the entire course and put up all the scoreboards that you see now.
Yeah.
That was the first.
Yeah. It seems to me that's what they continue to do. They continue to find subtle ways to improve the experience, to make it more, you know, to give us that feeling that, you know, this is continuing the place we want to be. This is the pinnacle.
It absolutely is. And those changes have started happening almost from day one. Everybody talks about all the changes that go on at Augusta and all this. Changes have been going on at Augusta since Augusta's been around.
Yeah.
And it's only when you go back and you look at photographs from the 1930s or the 1950s or the 1960s where you can start spotting what some of those differences are. But Augusta National is a clearly developing entity, and it is always changing, and it is always looking for ways to improve.
What's the lasting memory you'll have of your grandfather?
Frank, I think you stumped me a little bit here. It's funny. I mean, it has nothing really much to do with golf. But I can still see him to this day. You know, by the time this memory came along, I mean, he was well in the throes of his disease. And I remember he was sitting in his chair in the in his living room. And he smoked. And so my job when I was there, since he couldn't handle a cigarette holder, my job would be to put his cigarette in his mouth, take it out of his mouth, tap the ash, right? And we were getting ready to go, and I'd put a cigarette in his mouth, and I had the attention span of a flea. And I'd forgotten that was there. And finally, all of a sudden, I hear Bub just going, "Arr! And I look over and there's an ash about that long on the cigarette. And I was like, "Oh, Bub, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry." And I took the cigarette out of his mouth and I flicked the ash. I said, "Do you want it back?" He said, "No, son, I think I'm good for a while now." But then he looked at me and he just looked at me and he said, I said, "Bub, I'm so sorry." And he goes, "That's okay, son." And then he looked me right in the eye and he just said, "I really love you, son." And I said, "I love you too, Bub." And we got ready to leave that day. Of course, we all had to go give Bub a kiss. And now Bub was not one of these that's going to give you a little peck on the cheek, manly-like kiss. Bub was a big, wet, kiss you on the lips kind of guy. And I remember giving Bub a kiss. And I didn't know that was going to be the last or one of the last times that I was going to see him. But he passed away in December of 1971. The thing I value the most, funny enough, has nothing to do with golf. It is recordings of his. He was a big lover of classical music, and he had the 9 Beethoven symphonies performed by Arturo Toscanini and the NBC Symphony Orchestra. And they were in this brown leather case with a big bronze medallion in the middle of it. And one day I was listening to those while Bub was at work. I didn't realize that Bub couldn't handle a record anymore because of his hand. So I'm just listening to these. And Bub came back from work a little early and I didn't know he was coming. And I thought I was going to be in big trouble because here I was playing with his records. And he came in the room and I'm just sitting there listening. I think I was listening to Beethoven's 6th symphony or something. One of the 9. I know it was 1 through 9. And Bub looked at me and he goes, "Well, son, what are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I'm listening to these Beethoven recordings." He said, "Well, do you like them?" I said, "Oh, Bub, I think they're fantastic." And he said, "Well, they're yours. They're the prize of my collection, wow. And they're yours." And I still have them to this day. So I've got a few memories.
I don't think I stumped you with that question.
Probably not.
How would he feel? You know, we all want to leave a mark, make a difference. And it sounds like he was so busy doing what he was doing, he never took the time to think about what difference he might have made. If there was a moment for him to kind of look back on his life and, take some pride in it. Do you see him doing that? What would he be most proud of, do you think?
I think he was proud. Certainly he was proud of his accomplishments on the golf course. He was proud of his family. But, you know, I think I would answer the question simply this way. For a number of years, people wanted to know, what can we do to make a monument to Bob Jones? And Bub and members of the Augusta National would come and they would think, well, maybe we can have a statue erected. And Bub used to always be very, very forceful about that. He would say, and it really wasn't humility. I mean, it was humility, but it wasn't. He never wanted a statue. He always said, the course itself is monument enough to me. And I don't think that was just a way of saying, oh, you know, I want to just poo-poo that whole thing. I think he recognized that the Augusta National Golf Course and everything that it had become associated with truly reflected what was meaningful in his life. So that's how I think I would answer that.
As we approach Masters Week again this year, from your point of view, what should we be looking for? How do we best enjoy the Masters?
Well, you know, we've got this wonderful thing now that's really helpful in enjoying the Masters, and that is YouTube. And you can go and you can watch the Masters channel on YouTube, and you can learn about past tournaments, and you can actually watch videos of past tournaments going back decades. And you can learn, how did the great players of the past play the game? How did, he won't be here this year, but how did Tiger actually play the game? What was 1997 really all about? Mm. What was 1986 really all about? Who were some of these great legends of the game. And then when they watch the golf tournament, what they'll notice is, even though the equipment has changed and the ball has changed and the way we maintain the course has changed, there is a tremendous continuity between the Masters as it was, the Masters, and the Masters as it is now. And they will see that no matter what the year, the flowering azaleas have always been there, the dogwood trees in bloom. If you stand up on the top of the hillside, you can just see the clouds of pollen that drift with the wind across, you know, across the golf course. And they can get just a taste of what it's like to stand somewhere on the golf course after you've been there a few times and you hear a roar coming up from the somewhere on the golf course, and you know exactly where it is and you know exactly who's out there. And based on the roar, whether it's a big cheer or whether it's just this, oh, big groan, you know what's happened. And then that moment where you stand there and you just wait with your eyes fixed on that scoreboard to see those gates come down, because you know you're going to see the number come up that then shows you when that gate closes, whether it was just this moment of tremendous achievement or this moment of tremendous disaster. And you can get all of that by kind of learning about where this place has been and what has made it what it is now. That's maybe a little bit of a poetic answer to your question, but that's my thoughts on it anyway.
Oh, I don't know, Dr. Bob, you've given me chills. So I think it was pretty good poetry there.
Thank you.
Your grandfather died of a horrible disease called syringomyelia. And yes. You are, you know, it's, the foundation that looks at ways to find a cure is very near and dear to your heart. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, the original foundation was the Chiari and Syringomyelia Foundation, which are two related conditions. And a number of years back, we decided to lend the Jones name to it. And it is now known as the Bobby Jones Chiari and Syringomyelia Foundation. Your viewers can find it at bobbyjonescsf.org. Each year we do a fundraising golf tournament. This year it's going to be this coming Monday at the 28th. And it'll be held at East Lake Golf Club, where we play it each year. The people at East Lake are just wonderful hosts to us. And we have played in other places as well. Just last October, we played at Winged Foot in Mamaroneck, New York. And we hope to have other sites in the future as well. But if your viewers would like, go to bobbyjonescsf.org, take a look at some of the great work they're doing. And if they feel so moved as to make a donation, we would be tremendously honored to find a cure for this condition that at any given point is afflicting 3 million people. So we would appreciate it.
Dr. Bob, I appreciate your time. I appreciate your expertise. I appreciate your emotion and everything you've brought to this little conversation today. It means a lot to me. Dr. Bob, Robert T. Jones IV is a licensed psychologist, and he is the grandson of the iconic Bobby Jones, and he is one of the people who play the game, and we appreciate you being with us today.
Thank you so much, Frank. I really appreciate being asked.
It's the Golf to Go Hour with Frank LaRosa.
This is the Golf to Go Radio Hour. I'm Frank LaRosa, along with Scott Marsh. That's been a fun, exciting interview with Bob Jones IV, again, the grandson of Bobby Jones, and all of that makes great sense, and the timing is just perfect with this week being the Masters week, and as my partner Scott says, the greatest week in golf, and certainly for him. You know, you and three of your friends set out to go to the Masters, but along the way you decided you were going to play some golf, so you played five rounds of golf in South Carolina before you headed over to Augusta.
Yeah, we were on the Hilton Head Island, so we were able to play Herring Point. It's a Pete Dye course, which is fantastic. We played Atlantic Dunes, which is designed by Davis Love III. terrific course. We played Oyster Reef Club, which is a nice little inland club a little bit. And then we played Palmetto Dunes, which is right out on the beach where we were staying at Hilton Head. And then we wrapped it up with Harbor Town, which of course is the course where the PGA event will be next week after the Masters. So that was certainly a lot of fun to see that course as well.
You know, when people talk about golf destinations, certainly Hilton Head and that area of the country comes up as one of the great locations. And here in Northern California, we would counter with the Monterey Peninsula. And I don't necessarily want you to compare them, but, you know, give us the reasons why people should make that trip like you did.
The weather was fantastic, particularly this time of year. Perfect place to be. Great food, great dining. I would compare it to Pebble Beach in a lot of ways. You know, it certainly has a feel in terms of the number of courses and things that you can do, and being close to the ocean and all those types of things. So, I mean, there is only one Pebble Beach, so let's not mistake that. But there's a lot of great golf courses out in South Carolina and Hilton Head where we were at, just like on the Monterey Peninsula.
Yeah, but all of that was just a warm up to you, you boys getting in the car and heading up to Augusta. And tell me, you know, everybody talks about their experience going down Magnolia Lane.
Well, you cannot go down Magnolia Lane, so it is closed to the public, but you can drive by it on Washington Avenue. So we drove by it, and you just kind of look off to the right, and you look down, you're trying to snap a photo as you're still having to drive down the street, and you can see it. And the first thing that amazes you is that you're so used to the iconic photo, but it's so small. You know, it seems so large, and it is larger than life, but in reality, it's not a long lane whatsoever. But it's extremely beautiful. But yeah, it's not something that obviously us common people can just turn our car and make a right and head down Magnolia Lane.
Again, we're going to talk more about this on our show next week. But what was it like, you know, stepping foot on the grounds the first time?
Amazing. You know, it feels like you're in a surreal experience. It's Disneyland for anybody who loves golf. You feel like you're in a different era, a different time that is just so pristine and so beautiful. And you know all the history. And as you walk out, we decided to walk the back nine. And on Tuesday, because of the rain and everything else, that's all we were able to do. But as you walk towards Amen Corner and you see that and the azaleas and all the beauty and the tee shot from 13, you go down to 15 to 16 where the par three and all the players, because it's light on a practice round, they're trying to skip it over the water and onto the green. And that's so much fun. And all the groups that are coming up and in, and then you walk up 17, you get to 18 and you see that final hole as you see it veer to the right with the sand trap on the left-hand side. And you just soak it all in because you've seen it so many times on TV. It's just, it's an amazing experience to see it in person.
How many players are, who are the players did you get to tag along with?
You know, we didn't tag along with any groups. We just kind of walked the course, and who was there we saw. So we saw a lot of Bryson DeChambeau. We saw Tiger Woods on the putting range. We saw Bernhard Langer with Larry Mize. And that's the great thing. You see so many different generations.
What a trip of a lifetime. And
for sure.
You know, there's a whole lot more to talk about. And we're going to do that, as I said, on next week's show. Also on next week's show, we're trying to get a hold of Jason Dumdemaya, and Jason won his age category in the drive pitch and putt. That's what it is, which was held right there at Augusta National. And Jason is from the area, and we're gonna talk to him next week as well. But nothing I can say will top your experience. So basically, I'm just going to kind of let you conclude with one last thought about the Masters.
Well, if you haven't been there, you got to get there once in your lifetime for sure.
That's Scott Marsh with his thoughts about the Masters. And as we come back next week, we'll know who our winner was, and we'll have more to talk about. So congratulations on a great trip. Scott, this is the Golf to Go Radio Hour. Frank LaRosa, Scott Marsh. See you all next week.